Welcome to the Everyday Oral Surgery Podcast. This is your host, Dr. Grant Stuckey. I am an oral and maxillofacial surgeon practicing in Denver. In this podcast, you will hear from OMS surgeons all over the globe discussing ways to improve the practice of oral and maxillofacial surgery. Most of the information shared in this podcast will be based on personal experience and opinions, so please supplement what you learn here with the approved research studies. If you are a regular follower of the podcast, please go to our website, everydayoralsurgery.com. There you can find the episodes in a more searchable fashion. You can post questions about the various topics, and you can also sign up for the weekly newsletter. Most importantly, if you would like to be interviewed on the podcast or know someone you would like to hear from, please email me at grantstuckey@gmail.com. Without further ado, please enjoy today's episode. Welcome to yet another episode of Everyday Oral Surgery. This is our resident series that we recently started. Jake, thank you so much for joining me.
Glad to be here. Yep. It'll be fun.
Good. Last time we talked about MRONJ. Today we're going to try and tackle a little bit about infections and some of the deep space abscesses that can happen. This series is more for the newer residents who are kind of getting into things. So certainly we're not going to delve into all the minutiae that you may encounter on an oral boards exam. So probably we won't be saying the phrase Jamel Malor Balorum in this lecture, because that is getting down to the nitty gritty of infections. Who knows, maybe it will show its rear its ugly head, but we're going to focus more on the basic stuff today.
Yes. Good stuff. Stuff that, you know, it's just, you got to know, and you'll probably be pimped on or asked questions about, and it comes up on a regular basis.
Yep. So odontogenic infections, for those brand new residents, because this is a perfect time of year to discuss this. There's probably a lot that have been getting hit up over the last week and will continue for the next several years with pages regarding infections in the OR. We thought this would be good to kind of answer some of the questions that new first year and interns are having about how to work up and kind of treat infection patients, basically. So let's kick it off, Jake. My first question for you, let's set the stage. So you're a brand new resident, you're paged to the ED to take a look at an dental abscess patient. That's what they tell you. It's an abscess patient. Can you come take a look? So what is your workup going to involve for a patient like that?
So, you know, big things with infections is, first of all, just figuring out how severe it is, right? What's going on with the patient? Getting that idea of, is it something that we can quickly take care of in the ED and send them home? Or is this something that's going to be potentially life-threatening? Go to the OR immediately and, you know, take care of this right now so it doesn't get any worse. So that's kind of like in the back of my head, trying to figure out how severe is this. Some of those things that I'm going to be looking at with the patient, about the patient, to figure that out is, you know, what led to this? Like, what's the dental scenario going on? How did they present? Why did they decide to come to ED? What's their medical history, their background there? What do their vitals look like right now in the ED? And then usually the lab, you know, the emergency department has already drawn a couple labs or done some imaging, but if they haven't, I'd want to look at their labs, you know, see what's going on there. How is their body responding to the infection? And then get some imaging so we can take a look at exactly how involved is it? What areas is involved? Is there any fluid? And kind of start putting all of these pieces together to determine, you know, what we need to do for the patient.
Yes, that's good. Maybe you could start us a little bit with your just first clinical exam. So you walk into the little bay or whatever it is, little room, curtained off room in the ED. How does your clinical exam kind of go, or what is it going to consist of when you're dealing with an infection patient?
So first of all, I like to just get a broad kind of idea of how they're doing, right? So I'm going to look at their overall status. Are they, you know, resting in bed? They're doing pretty well. Are they sitting up, sitting forward, breathing very heavily, having a real hard time trying to breathe? Are they like drooling because they can't swallow their spit? Just take a quick look at their face. Is it way asymmetric, you know, sticking out to the side? So that's kind of the first thing before we even talk to them, just see how do they look. Are they sick? You know, as they say in the ED, are they quote unquote sick, really sick? or are they not sick and you have some more time to figure out what's going on? And then from there, part of the exam, so you're going to want to take a look at their airway, you know, just like with like any like ABCs, right? Your first thing is with their airway, are they breathing fine? They're breathing, you know, they're passing air, they're sitting well. Take a look at their asymmetry. So feel their face, feel the inferior border of the jaw. Can you feel the bone all the way around? There's nothing like impeding it, like swelling or potentially some fluid. Do a real thorough just oral exam, noticing if you have any fluctuants. Most of the time, the patient's going to say, like, don't touch this tooth, whatever you do, don't touch it. You know, they'll like point right to where the area is. They'll tell you exactly what's going on and you can see it. But, you know, you're going to want to feel around and see, is there any drainage? Is it just not draining, but it's just swollen? How does their bite look? And then also check in their throat, right? If you can take a look at their uvula, is it right down the middle? Is it pushed off to one side because one of those pillars is swollen or inflamed? And then how's their MIO, right? Can they open their mouth? Sometimes they're so swollen or the infection's involving spaces that are causing irritation to those muscles and they can't even open their bite, right? So you start looking at all these different factors to get an idea of both, you know, how severe it is, where is the infection, and how are you going to treat it?
Yeah, I like that a lot. I mean, I would add to that, you know, when I would walk into a room and the patient's laying back in bed, which is common, and they're just chilling there with their hands crossed and their legs straight, usually you're thinking, okay, this person is someone who can handle their secretions and they're not having much trouble in the way of breathing or swallowing. That's not always the case. Some people are trying, are kind of, you know, faking it, that type of thing. But most people that it's pretty severe, deep space abscess involving multiple spaces, that's kind of encroaching on your airway and your ability to swallow, they're going to be sitting on the edge of the bed, leaning forward, right? And they're going to be kind of doing that to posture and what we call a sniffing position, where their head's a little more extended to open up their airway. I mean, super subtle things that the more times you examine someone, the more you kind of pick up on stuff like this. But things that you can have in the back of your mind as, well, this might be a little more of an involved infection. They're sitting on the edge of the bed, they're leaning forward, hands are on their knees. Sometimes even they have that little kidney bean, that shaped bowl, you know, underneath, and their saliva is just dripping down their chin. You know, something pretty significant's going on in the back of their throat that's stopping them from being able to swallow their saliva.
Right. And then another physical finding that's like one of the most basic of all is just their vitals, right? Are they tachycardic with a fever? And what's their blood pressure? So you just take a quick look at those. They have a fever of 102, they're tachycardic, they're dehydrated. Starts adding to that picture and showing you, you know, this is something involving, you know, much more than just a little tooth, right?
I would add too, with the MIO, which stands for maximum incisal opening, you know, I'd say, okay, open your mouth. And oftentimes they're open and it's just like barely, right? Maybe you could put a finger or two in there. And usually I do the scissor fingers, you know, I'd stick, try to get two fingers in there and start trying to a little scissor finger and open them. Because that will tell you real quick if it's a true trismus, you know, if that's rock hard and there's no give when you're trying to open them with your thumb and your index finger, that is a very ominous sign that you've got a pretty well-developed, significant, or maybe not well-developed, maybe just raging cellulitis, but it's surrounding their big muscles of mastication and they physically cannot open their mouth because the infection is putting pressure on those muscles. Versus somebody who has a vestibular abscess, the infection isn't really around the muscles of mastication and they kind of open a little bit, but they're guarding. And then you put your finger in, you scissor them and boom, you can get them pretty wide open. And yeah, they're going to scream like heck.
Yeah.
Because maybe the infection is starting to make those muscles sensitive, but it's not physically impeding the muscles of mastication yet.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
And we call that guarding, right? Guarding as opposed to true trismus. Anyways, okay, so you've done your exam, walked out of the room, told the nurse maybe what to order. What's on your list of things real quick? You mentioned some, but what is usually the main things that you're going to order or have on your radar to get going quick?
So the most important thing for me to start with would just be like a CBC. So we could take a look at their white count, mm-hmm. see if it's elevated and how elevated it is. And then if you already have a strong suspicion that you're going to want to take this patient to the OR, just for like practicality reasons, there are some other labs that your hospital probably requires, or you know, you should order just to get going. You know, for example, our hospital, you got to order a type in screen, coags, you know, just in case this patient were to have some sort of bleeding event in the OR, you would be prepared for that. But in terms of like diagnosis, we'll start with the CBC.
Yeah.
And we, I'd like usually get a CT facial bones with contrast, so we can check that out if they haven't done that already.
Sorry, usually I said nurse, but usually I would try to go find the ED physician, you know, or resident who's taking care of the patient, go talk to them directly and say, hey, here's what we're thinking. It's probably, I don't know, submandibular with some pterygomandibular influence. Get those labs that you're saying, but then like immediately this patient needs to be NPO,
mm-hmm.
and be specific with that. Because I've seen myself and other residents have gotten burned by not putting in those surgical orders and getting them ready for surgery.
Yeah, true.
And, 3 hours later, now that our tending is available, we tell them about the situation. Okay, let's go to the OR right now. And, oh, crap, no one told them to do NPO. They've been, you know, chugging orange juice like all afternoon.
Right. And additionally, usually at this point, you know, we'd start them on antibiotics, right? Just get those going, IV antibiotics.
Yep.
And we'll get more into the details of that, but it's at this point that we would do that. Obviously, during your workup of their medical history, you'd ask them for any allergies and take that into account when you pick your antibiotic.
So good things to keep in mind. Make sure you order those things. Of course, if you're a brand new resident, you're going to want to, you know, call your upper level and kind of verify a lot of this stuff. Have some type of algorithm or list of things, you know, so you can kind of run it through and even in a notebook if you need to look at it, so you're not forgetting things, because it's so much better to pay attention to detail right after you do the exam than it is, or even before you do the exam, than it is to get into hot water with some of the stuff. Okay. Anything you want to discuss with this workup phase?
Yeah, sorry. So one thing is, I think is good practice once we get the imaging back is just to get used to taking a look at the imaging before you read the report. That's how I was told to do it and trained to do it. And I think it does help you get a kind of hone in your skills of figuring out how involved that is. Sometimes they'll have the imaging even before you see the patient, which makes it even a little tricky to do it because you haven't seen clinically how they look and you're still trying to figure out what's going on. But yeah, taking a look at that CT and determining, you know, is there any fluid collection consistent with an abscess? Is it more like cellulitis? What does the asymmetry look like, both just in their soft tissue and then also paying close attention to the airway, which, you know, on the CT for, you know, the new residents who haven't looked at many CTs will be the black space, right? Because black is air. So you'll look at the black. It's usually, you know, relatively small, but if you see an asymmetry where the side of the infection is kind of narrowing that space, that's concerning. Or overall, if you see the space is, you know, very narrow, that's also concerning. And then trying to just get an idea for where it's at. Is it, you know, in the anterior of the jaw, just in the vestibular area, or is it real far posterior, you know, extending kind of in the masticator space, involving some of those muscles that, like we said, that might cause trismus. So just getting used to looking at the CT exams for ourselves, the different slices, you know, with the different views. There's like a bony window. You're going to want to usually look at the bony window for like teeth, right? Seeing maybe where which tooth is involved and where it's perforating the bone, and then switching to the soft tissue window so you can take a much closer look at the swelling and potentially where the abscess itself is located. And then, of course, you can take a look at the report as well to kind of cross-check.
Yep. I would say usually, and I'm guessing this is for the case for most residents, but generally like you get paged, you know, you call the ED physician, says, hey, I got this patient here. You know, we're thinking it's this big abscess of the jaw, whatever. I'll order these orders, put them MPO. Like usually that happens at the beginning. And then usually right then they say, okay, what do you want me to order? And the best answer I would think that is going to help you the best to diagnose an infection is a CT scan with contrast. The question is why contrast? That helps you to better see blood vessels, of course, because contrast is kind of lights up when it's running through blood vessels and leaking into soft tissue. In the case of a, you know, an abscess, especially if it's more of a developed abscess. And we'll talk about this, the stages of abscess, but when it's more developed, blood vessels have kind of grown around and really migrated into that area, right? To get good immune cells around the abscess. And so what you see oftentimes in one of these CT scans that has contrast, and the radiologist will write it in their notes, is a rim enhancing fluid collection lateral to the mandible, let's say, or medial to the mandible. That basically they're saying, so fluid collection means pus. That's another way of saying it when we're dealing with infections. It could mean other things when you're not dealing with infection. Rim enhancing means that the contrast is flowing around that fluid collection because the patient has, you know, blood vessels that migrated around this ball of pus that's in their jaw or next to their jaw. And so you may see some of that. When it's prior to a well-developed, you know, ball of pus or collection of pus, purulence, usually there's what we call fat stranding, which is, you know, the body starting to grow blood vessels there and swelling happening, the bacteria proliferating, but your body hasn't had enough time to form this kind of defined ball of fluid and put all these white blood cells together to make up that fluid collection. So just trying to get you familiar, these newer residents, with some of the terminology that you're going to read in a report, or, you know, maybe I hear upper level residents talking about this while they're scrolling through and you're like, well, what does fat stranding mean, or rim enhancing collections and all this stuff? That can be helpful.
Yeah, for sure. That was great. And then kind of going along with when you're looking at just where exactly the infection is located, how do you determine the severity of the space, right? So like, which locations around the jaw are considered low severity versus moderate and severe? And I know that we could get way into the details of like exactly the boundaries of each space. For today, we're not going to do that because that's a lot of kind of nitty gritty details. But just which spaces are, in general, are low versus moderate versus more severe.
Exactly. And with that said, I would say definitely the most common, you know, deep space involved. And studies show this, but certainly in my residency, and I think in most, is going to be the submandibular abscess or space. Again, when we talk about spaces, we're talking about potential spaces. So these spaces don't exist in a regular healthy person. These are spaces that are quote unquote potential because your muscles and your fascia and everything is all pressed up against each other in a normal person, and there is no space. There's just, you know, structure touching structure. In an infection patient, bacteria has, and white blood cells and all this stuff, has had the chance to get in between structures and start creating a space that didn't exist there before. So the submandibular, real quick, if we were to, you know, talk about a severity, and yet you could find this in Peterson's, but there's the two that kind of moderate and severe are the two ones you really want to know what's involved in those and why. The moderate spaces basically are called moderate because they involve the masticator space. And that means these are infections that are getting in around your big chewing muscles, your masseteric spaces, your temporalis muscle, and then your pterygoids, so your pterygomandibular. But basically, it's the submandibular, submental, sublingual, pterygomandibular, submasseteric, superficial, temporal, and deep temporal. All the abscesses and cellulitises that involve those spaces are going to give you trismus, most likely, and are going to lead to a situation where it's more difficult for you to access the airway.
Exactly.
Do you want to tell us what's in the high?
Sure. And going off of what you were saying, like we said, having severe trismus primarily is a big issue, because if you were to try to intubate that person, it'd be much more difficult, right? And so if they were to lose their airway, that's severe, right? So that's why it's getting that moderate range. Also, those spaces are very, very close to, they're just one step away from getting to the severe spaces, right? If they just spread a little bit further, they're going to start involving much deeper and much more, you know, dangerous areas. So that's why they're moderate, because they can get there quickly. So the high severity spaces are like the lateral pharyngeal, retropharyngeal, pretracheal, the danger space, also kind of mentioned as space 4 in some texts, and then the mediastinum, and then an intracranial infection. So all those spaces are much more severe because they can either directly compromise the airway or cause some sort of other serious, very serious systemic involvement. So like obviously the mediastinum is a very deep space infection that can be extremely severe. And then intracranial obviously is going to be very severe. So when talking about these spaces, like I mentioned, there's like different boundaries, and with time, we might do another episode where we discuss like how it can spread from one space to another, you know, from the lateral pharyngeal to the retropharyngeal and how those spaces are connected. But I think the big idea is that those spaces have a direct connection going downward, and the pretracheal space, they can connect directly to the mediastinum, right? Which is the space, you know, around our heart, between our lungs, around our heart. There's kind of that almost like a rectangular spaced box in our thorax that would be the mediastinum. So it's good to know those high severity locations as well, and to be able to, I don't know if you can necessarily identify those on a CT facial bones. You'd probably, if you were concerned about those, you'd want to probably get additional imaging, the CT of the neck or potentially the chest, and go from there.
One anatomic thing that I also thought was kind of interesting or cool that leads to so many infections in the submandibular space. You know, if you were to look at a real mandible, like a skull, that's an actual one, and you see that, and you look inside, and you'll see that ridge on the inside of the mandible, right? That's called the mylohyoid ridge. And you'll see how that from running anterior to posterior, it rises up as you go posterior on the mandible, and it creates this kind of, you know, rise so that the mylohyoid ridge is kind of running above the root apices of your, you know, first, second, third molars, more of the second and third, but can sometimes be the first. And so what happens is when those molars get infection, that infection oftentimes will go through the lingual, where it's oftentimes a thinner, weaker plate compared to the buccal. And now, instead of being contained above the mylohyoid, which is, you know, more
like floor of the mouth, or
yeah, more on the floor of mouth, which is, you know, not quite as dangerous. Now it's getting under the mylohyoid, getting a lot closer to your airway, and is much deeper, and it can hide itself more. So it just gets more involved once you start dipping under that mylohyoid ridge and getting under the mylohyoid muscle.
Mm-hmm. One thing I wanted to mention that you may have is during the physical exam, like knowing that, I always like to kind of press or to feel the floor of the mouth, right? Because sometimes you'll press and it's real soft and squishy. You're in a very soft, that's normal. Sometimes you'll reach in there and you'll see the floor of the mouth is like up to the level of the occlusion, right? It's like raised way up there. Or you'll touch it and it's just rock solid. You know, it does not depress at all, and their tongue is sticking out. And you know, it just goes to show you when you see that, it helps you kind of realize like, okay, now I see why this infection can compromise their airway, because it's so hard and it's pushing their tongue way up. You know, almost like obstructive sleep apnea, where if you get like a big tongue, or if your tongue starts getting in the way of the airway, it's much harder to breathe.
Yeah, good point. And it's just, it can't really drain itself when it's anterior to the mylohyoid ridge, the premolars and the anterior teeth. It's more likely to self-drain, right? Because it's closer to the surface. It's right under that skin. And oftentimes the patient will come in and tell you, oh yeah, just whatever, yesterday, all of a sudden this big flow of pus happened, you know, in my mouth and under my tongue. And it was disgusting.
Yeah.
That is much more difficult to happen when it's trapped under the mylohyoid muscle. Anyways, so how about rate of progression? How do you determine, you know, how quickly something's happening in a patient?
I think from there, it's just off of the HPI. So you're discussing with your patient, usually you're going to say, you know, can you tell me what happened, or what brought you in today? What's been going on? And so you're going to collect their history of present illness, right? And they usually will tell you kind of a long, confusing story about how a couple months ago and this and that. Distill it down in your mind. That's like, what exactly is going on? So you want to figure out like, when did, you know, how long have they had severe pain, and when did they start noticing swelling, right? Because this tooth could have been having issues for years, but they'll say 3 days ago, it started to swell and I saw my dentist and started taking antibiotics or whatever it may be. And then, you know, last night it just got huge, right? It got really, really big and I came in this morning. So kind of getting that idea versus a different story when they would say like, oh, it's been hurt a couple weeks. It was draining for a couple of weeks, but I just couldn't, you know, get anything done. It's been getting slowly, slightly worse and worse, and it was getting very hard. And so I decided to come in, you know?
Yeah.
So kind of hearing that story and noticing, okay, so it's been swelling over time and it's been very slowly growing versus like it just blew up overnight. Even though both stories, the patient might make it seem like it's been going on for months. You know, you kind of learn how to figure out truly how fast the acute stage of this infection is progressing.
So we discussed a lot about how to kind of assess the patient from a clinical standpoint, some of the orders to put in. Real quick, in regards to their other health problems, you know, like why does it even matter? Because, I mean, infections and infections. An abscess, you're draining it. Who cares if they have X, Y, and Z problems? Why does that matter?
Well, you know, it's kind of the whole idea of it's a systemic. Once it gets to that point where they're febrile and their whole body's starting to kind of get into gear to keep this thing contained, is their body capable of doing that effectively, right? So we look at conditions that can impair their immune state. So you know, diabetes, right, can have poor wound healing, like we talk about even after extractions. But when it comes to infections, they can have a decreased function of their white cells to hold that infection down. Steroid therapy, they could be on chronic steroids for, you know, any number of conditions, and steroids can obviously decrease their immune state. Organ transplants, they're going to be immunocompromised, and they're probably going to be on a whole host of medications that are keeping their immune system at bay just to, you know, protect the organs that they've received, which has that negative side effect of not being able to have their immune system function as well. Malignancy in and of itself decreases our immune status. Chemotherapy is a huge attack on the body. It's going to decrease the cells that quickly turn over, which would be, you know, immune cells. Chronic kidney disease, malnutrition, alcoholism, and obviously, you know, like HIV and AIDS, which is obviously a condition that has decreased white cell count if it's not well controlled. So, you know, you're looking at all these things when you're doing your evaluation of the patient. You're going to see, do they have any of these things in their history or any risk factors for these? Because maybe that infection blew up from yesterday to today, but it can give you an idea. If they're immune compromised, you have to be even that much more on your guard for it progressing quickly.
Yeah, it's a good point. So there's certain types of systemic problems that are affecting your immune system, and that can make this infection rage so much quicker, faster, and get out of control. I like to think of it as like a healthy person. Their body, their immune system is like a helicopter parent, right? And that's watching every little thing, and they're micromanaging. Oh, little Tommy, don't touch that. Nope, step away. And they're there, you know, with their taser, and they're hitting little Tommy in the back. Ah! I would never do that. And then the person with some type of immune compromising situation, especially diabetes is the most common, is the parent who's just like, you know, I really don't care what the heck you do. Just run wild, kid. You know, go to the Stookie's house next door and eat in their pantry. Do whatever you want to do. I'm sick and tired of watching you. Just go take care of it. So it's like a kid running bonkers, you know, in a fun house or neighborhood.
Exactly.
That's the diabetes, malignancy, chemotherapy, all these things. Malnutrition, alcoholism, AIDS can do to your ability to stop an infection.
Exactly.
So let's go back to this new resident. They've successfully kind of put in all the orders and, you know, patients getting antibiotics, getting them all ready for surgery. And I guess we're assuming that this is a deep space infection and the patient needs to be admitted. Maybe that's a quick question. You know, what are indications to admit the patient to the hospital?
Right. Well, I mean, like you mentioned, if you're going to need to take that patient to the OR, then you'd want to bring them in. If they have severe systemic involvement, right, all those things that we mentioned, they get fevers, high white count, so you'd want to admit them. And then once you get them in, like we discussed, you're going to want to talk about bringing them to surgery, right? Because like they always say, right, a chance to cut is a chance to cure. And that's especially applicable to infections. I mean, whether it's even just like an advanced cellulitis or an abscess, literature shows that if you go in and do the surgery and put a drain in there, you know, overall those patients are going to recover like much, much more quickly than if you weren't to do that and just put them on strictly antibiotics. So let's say you had a patient, you know, come in a scenario with like a submandibular abscess. What would be, could you just like walk us through what would be your approach to draining that abscess if when you took him to the OR?
Okay. So if this, you know, is a patient, let's say the patient's on the table, they've been intubated. Well, let me say before that, with any deep space infection, you want to be very involved in what the anesthesiologist is doing. You don't want to be chilling with your buddies at the computer, pulling up Pandora and trying to figure out what station you're going to be doing. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of these people have cellulitis and things that are going on that's going to make it more difficult for the anesthesiologist to intubate the patient, especially a patient who has, you know, significant things involving the airway. Let's say it's a laryngeal and there's an abscess and a fluid collection there, and the anesthesiologist, you know, is trying to put a tube down, and heaven forbid the tube catches on the inside of the tonsillar pillar and actually ruptures, you know, a portion of that fluid collection. And now you have purulence and stuff draining down the patient's throat. There's all sorts of things that can go wrong. So I think the two main ones are trismus, the amount of opening they have, and trying to help out with getting the mouth open. And if it's not opening much, being right there, because we're the experts in the mouth. And oftentimes the anesthesiologists, especially, you know, younger residents, are more hesitant with opening a mouth and not feeling kind of awkward. So being there with the patient with trismus, and two, doing whatever you can to avoid ruptures and things happening in the mouth while they're doing it. So one thing to even consider is taking kind of a needle with a syringe on it and trying to decompress intraorally an abscess or fluid collection that's there. In that example, I stated that might be a good idea, but really being involved and talking with anesthesiologists beforehand and kind of being right there when they're doing their job. So that's step one. Let's say that now the anesthesiologist has been successful. They've intubated, the patient's there, everyone's put the head wrapped and prepped them and everything. And you're all ready to go, you know, certainly, basically for submandibular, I would say once they're all prepped, or how I was trained and how I still do it is I palpate the inferior board of the mandible. And if it helps you, I think when you're a new resident, it's sometimes helpful to even get like a purple marking pen or something to mark with. Mark the inferior border wherever you think it is. Sometimes it's very hard to palpate, but you can kind of start anterior and walk back with your fingers. So mark the inferior border and the corner of the mandible and the ramus, the ingle. And then usually we would do two finger width below the inferior border. And then we put a little mark there, kind of a mid ramus or a little anterior to the mid ramus in that kind of Risdon, modified Risdon area. A little mark there where you're going to be making your incision. And that incision is small. You don't have to make a big incision, you know, not more than a centimeter or so. Just enough to get through the skin and through that subcutaneous layer. And then basically you're using your hemostat to punch through. We use a hemostat because the tips of the hemostat are blunt. You know, they're not sharp. They're not going to cut any vital structures. And so you usually poke through, right, through that subcutaneous layer. You poke through with your hemostat closed. And I will say, usually what we would do and kind of how I was trained is to have, you know, you got your both hands gloved up. Generally, we'd put our left hand, or I guess just you say one hand inside the mouth, kind of feeling intraorally, and your other hand with the hemostat. Mm-hmm. You don't have to do it this way, but this is how we did it. So you punch through, you take that closed hemostat to the inferior board of the mandible, so you're on bone, and then you kind of walk it medial if there's a pterygomandibular component. But certainly lateral and kind of medial to some extent for the submandibular. And you punch through close, you open them, and then you spread, and then you pull out with them open, the hemostat open. You never want to open and close your hemostat when you can't see the tips, because you could very well be crushing vital structures. There's nerves, there's, you know, salivary glands, all sorts of important structures. So you never close a hemostat when you have got it in the neck like that. And so usually at that first point, sometimes even just poking through initially, you know, if it's a well-defined abscess, the pus is going to start flowing.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was helpful to have that other hand in the mouth, and I have it usually like with my finger down on the lingual and my thumb to like my middle finger, index finger on the lingual aspect of the mandible by that first second molar, and then the thumb maybe on the buccal aspect. And so your finger is feeling kind of where that the tips of that hemostat are every time you go in, and you can kind of tell right where you are, and you're kind of, you know, rubbing it or tracing along that medial aspect to make sure you get any medial mandibular fluid collection there. And so we kind of do that a couple times, spreading, pull out, spread, pull out.
At that point, you just get a little quick little culture.
Yeah.
When it's a fluid bursts out of there.
That's a good question. I should have said that ahead of time. Usually before I even make my cut and punch through, I take an empty, you know, 10 cc syringe with a, I don't know, it's a 12 gauge or some type of needle that's fairly large bore, and poke it through where I'm going to make the incision, and then just aspirate. And, you know, usually whatever I aspirate there, I shoot it into the culture. So we would usually do that before. Now I do that. And also too, when the purulence is flowing out of the neck, we take another separate, you know, swab and swab that on the neck and put that in.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, good things to do. Once you've done your blunt dissection and kind of gotten most of those areas cleaned out, I irrigate usually with just normal saline. If it's just an intraoral thing and it's coming in the office, generally I'm irrigating with chlorhexidine or a mix of chlorhexidine and normal saline. I've had friends say that every program, you know, has their own way to do it. Some use bug juice and some swear by certain mixtures of chlorhexidine and things. But I always found that just normal saline does the job. Did you guys have any specific thing you do, or?
No, we just, for the most part, use normal saline in the OR and then chlorhexidine in the clinic. I mean, the point is just to dilute it, right? And mix it all out and get it clean, right?
Yeah. I don't know if you guys did this. This is something that one of our attendings insists on, but you can take one of those rubber stoppers, you cut the end off and you stick that on a big 20 or 30 cc syringe, you suck that up and then you shoot that. You kind of put the rubber stopper tip into the into your dissected area and flush it out. That's if you're an extreme flusher man.
No, usually we just use an OR. They have those like rubber like ball irrigators, so like the nurses will like squeeze them,
yeah,
let go and it fills up, and you just like stick the whole thing into the wound and just like squeeze and pump like real quick.
Mm-hmm.
And it just kind of like just sloshes it all around, and you're sure to get your shoes wet, and it's a good time.
Yeah. Yes.
Make sure you have some sort of like non-permeable shoe, please.
Good call. Make sure you're wearing your Crocs. But also too, it's worth mentioning that sometimes, and certain attendings insist on this a lot, but you can potentially go through, especially on the lingual, come out through the socket or through the lingual aspect right up against the mandible. And then you take your Penrose drain in, you pinch it with the hemostat and you go up through your extraoral, you know, neck incision, and then you pull it up through, and then you pull it actually through that lingual between the mandible and the lingual and the mucosa, and you kind of pull the Penrose all the way through, so you can kind of pull it back and forth between the mouth and the neck. And that's a good option if you want that space to stay open. The other thought is not to do that because you don't want to maintain this open communication where, you know, bacteria from the mouth is getting into the neck where it's not supposed to be. There's all sorts of different thoughts on that one. But the bottom line is to get a drain well into the space that where the abscess was. And we would suture it with usually a silk suture to keep it there for a couple days.
Mm-hmm.
Once we've done the neck cleaning out side of things on a submandibular, then, you know, we go inside the mouth, take out the offending tooth, and really get that all cleaned up and taken care of. You know, it's all for naught if you forget to take out the tooth.
Mm-hmm.
Heaven forbid I never did that, but I'm sure it's happened. Any other things you want to, technical tips on the actual procedure you want to add?
No. And I mean, as the resident series, you know, I am still a resident, so just learning these things together with everyone here listening. But that's the way I've seen it done. And I think that was a good overview.
Yeah. And I will say too, you know, if you're doing the technique where you have the one hand in the mouth, the other on the, you know, on the neck, you just need to be careful because you want to always minimize the amount of bacteria you're getting into your neck side of things,
mm-hmm.
regardless of if you put the Penrose through or not. And so I would never go in with my left hand into the mouth and then come out and then be adjusting the Penrose or whatever with my left hand that was just in the mouth. I would deglove or put a new sterile glove on top, but just be conscious of those things that you want to keep the neck as sterile as possible. And then when you're in the mouth, you stay in the mouth and then you finish, or if you're to go back to the neck, you've got to kind of re-sterilize.
Mm-hmm. So after this, you know, you've your patient's on antibiotics, you've had them drained, you put the drain in. Usually, you know, they'd be admitted. You keep checking on them a couple times a day. The next day, you know, what does it look like from there? I mean, what we do typically is, you know, we'd see them bright and early in the morning, evaluate the drainage, right? So usually you got some sort of like gauze on there, some sort of maybe like a 4x4, something folded in half with like a little piece of tape. And oftentimes that's been changed a couple of times by the nurses just because it had fluid on it. So it's good to talk to the nurse, you know, what did it look like? Have you changed it? You know, tell me about what's going on. But yeah, we would take a look at it and see. Usually we like to see what we call like serosanguineous drainage, meaning it's just like a little bit of pink, a little bit of clear fluid. It's not like a ton of pus. It's not like straight up blood, right?
Doesn't smell.
Exactly. So you look at it, it's a little bit of serosanguineous fluid. Maybe you know, flush it out if you want to. Normally we wouldn't. And if it hadn't been draining too much, you know, after about 24 hours or so, you can snip the suture and pull it. If it's a healthy patient, sometimes you can make the decision whether you want to send him home and maybe see him the next day in clinic to pull that drain, or if you're confident that it's, you know, doing pretty good, just take it out. For our patients that were maybe older or in those higher risk categories or more medical compromised, we'd maybe leave it in another day or two and follow them and make sure that they were really improving before we sent them home, pulled that drain, and then schedule, you know, follow up within a couple of days and keep a good eye on them until they're improving significantly. So that was kind of usually what we do. Anything to add, your guys' setup?
It was pretty strict for us the way we checked, and we would tell the nurse not to change it. One of our attendings was pretty extreme about that. They didn't want any nurse except the resident touching it because we need to see how much drainage there is. And
yeah.
And I mean, I think there's value in that. I think it's important for the surgeon to see how much drainage there is, what type of drainage. And it can be confusing if, you know, right before you round in the morning, you go in there and it looks great because you didn't realize that somebody else changed the dressing that was all purulent, and then, oh, it looks good. I'll pull the drain. And then next thing you know, they're coming back in 2 days with the kind of reinfected neck or whatever.
Yeah.
So I would just make sure someone who's trained and is really checking on things is doing that. You got to be following up with the patient, especially the patient who has some of these other issues like diabetes. So following up on, are they having their sugars checked and are they getting the insulin sliding scale? You know, is this really happening? Is there other immunocompromising things getting taken care of? Are they getting their antibiotics? I saw that more than once, that the order was in, but oh, if someone forgot to hang it, and, you know, or we go in the room, the bag sitting there and no one turned it on, stuff like that is just, you'd think would never happen, right? And
yeah,
this day and age, but it does. And so you have to check. And everyone's going to assume that the first year resident checked that. And if you didn't, you will probably be slapped in the face in a figurative sense. Cross your T's, dot your I's. And then I would say, like you're saying, once they're all ready, it's serosanguineous, you're feeling good about the drainage, you remove it, you put the dressing on, you send them out. You got to really hold their hand and make sure the patient knows how important it is to take their antibiotics and make sure they get the pill form and make sure they know when their follow-up appointment is in the clinic and all the stuff that seems basic. But, you know, the sad part of it is that a lot of the patients who are in these situations are people that are kind of in underserved areas, don't have the financial benefits that a lot of people have. And so you need to be communicating with that patient, you know, about their ability to get the antibiotics and to come to your clinic and to do all this good follow-up stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then, I mean, just as a couple of last points, so I feel like we addressed the vast majority of kind of how my experience was, and probably most residents of, you get a consult, what goes on in the OR, and how do you take care of the patient until you're basically ready to send them home. One thing we maybe didn't mention was when it comes to choosing which antibiotic you want to do specifically, typically for like inpatients, what we would do is if they have no allergies or no penicillin allergies, we'd start them on something like Unicin, which is like the ampicillin sulbactam. Mm-hmm. And then if they did have an allergy to penicillins, we'd just go with the clindamycin. Like, and these are IV medications. And then there's a whole bunch of other, you know, IV antibiotics available for a lot of scenarios. It gets into kind of a lot of depth, but we wanted to start with that. And then for an outpatient, let's say you're transitioning them off of the Unicin. You can transition them from Unicin to Augmentin, would be the equivalent of that in the oral form, or the clindamycin, you just transition to oral clindamycin. And then if you were to see a patient with just a small little abscess in your outpatient, you know, in clinic, you could just start them with just amoxicillin versus clindamycin, right? So those are the antibiotics we usually started with and kept them on, transitioned them to for what, like 5 to 7 days? That maybe like a week if it's severe, is that what you typically do?
Yeah, we were typically 7 days. Yeah. Important to follow up with the cultures. I mean, making sure you got the right thing. Usually they're resolving, they're going to do fine on that initial antibiotic, but especially if they're having trouble fighting it, you really want to consult infectious disease and make sure we're all fighting this from an antibiotic standpoint with the right things, because it can get pretty detailed as to what types of bacteria you know require what types of antibiotics and stuff like that. So just make sure you're following up with that stuff.
I was going to ask you, we mentioned that there are more like severe things that odontogenic infections can develop into. Mm-hmm. Not that we're going to discuss each one individually, but can you just mention what are some of those other things that can, you know, let's say you start with a submandibular abscess or some sort of odontogenic infection, what could it hypothetically turn into, you know, worst case scenario?
Well, I mean, I'd say worst case scenario is first and foremost, we're thinking like complete airway obstruction. So that is super dangerous. And so that's on the mind of most oral maxillofacial surgeons, because we're in the airway and we're just so focused on the airway and the teeth and the jaws and everything, right? So it's rare that an oral maxillofacial surgeon is going to not be aware of the airway issue. But with that said, you got to always be thinking of that.
Mm-hmm.
Really, the next thing I think that is not common, but the next kind of more really dangerous thing that can happen is necrotizing fasciitis. That's where infections basically, or the flesh-eating bacteria, you know, can kind of become pretty dangerous and rampant quickly. Usually you see that dusky kind of vessels on the surface of the skin, purple, starting to happen. But that can happen and can be very dangerous. So something you got to look for, especially in a diabetic patient. Like as soon as you know they're diabetic, that needs to be on high alert in your mind to constantly watching for that. You mentioned a little bit about mediastinitis or the infection kind of going, you know, through lateral pharyngeal around the posterior and getting into the danger space and then down into the mediastinum and causing mediastinitis, which is very dangerous. And then also cavernous sinus thrombosis can be a life-threatening situation as well. So stuff to be aware of. Anything else that's on your radar?
Just infections in general can develop into sepsis, right? Sepsis is a huge problem. It needs to be watched out for, especially, you know, watch out for their vitals, you know, making sure they don't get like hypotensive and all those kind of things. And then other things that I mentioned just when reviewing the literature, nothing I've seen, but I was reading about how it could develop into like thoracic empyema. Again, when it goes down inferiorly, if it involves like the thoracic cavities, or Lemierre syndrome, orbital abscesses, cerebral abscesses, it could just develop into osteomyelitis, which of the jaw, right? Which might need some additional surgical intervention or long-term antibiotics. So there are a lot of other things that like side effects or secondary things that can develop from the odontogenic infections that would be good to review. But,
yep,
you know, in general, when it comes to the basics or the standard I think we kind of hit on a lot of those important points.
I would say too, just as a new resident, make sure you're brushing up on your anatomy, the boundaries of the spaces, because that's a common thing to get pimped on. Definitely no excuse for not knowing your anatomy. Another thing is the stages of infection. We kind of touched on some of them, but maybe we can run through those. There's four stages that are kind of well documented or talked about. The first is inoculation. So that's usually day 0 to 3. And generally the clinical manifestation is when you're palpating it, it's soft, it's mildly tender. You know, the patient can kind of feel something's going on, but they're not too worried about it. The second stage is cellulitis, usually somewhere, I'd say, between day 2 to 5-ish, where the infection is becoming very, very provocative and inflammatory. It's when you palpate, it's super hard, it's red, it's exquisitely painful and sore to the touch. This is when oftentimes a patient, is like something real wrong is happening and comes into the emergency room if, they're semi-smart, or you get the tough guy who tries to hang in there. And that can develop into stage 3, which is the abscess, usually somewhere between whatever day 4 to 7-ish. And that's where the kind of what we talked about, that fluid filled ball of purulence develops. It's softer. Oftentimes you see that yellow tint on the skin if it's getting close, if it's at a space that's close to the skin. Sometimes there can be this kind of clinical finding of fluctuance. This kind of confused me for the first couple months of residency. I wasn't entirely sure what they were talking about, because there's all these terms of doughy, firm, rock hard, fluctuant, compressible, that are thrown around, and you're kind of like, what the heck? I swear they're saying this about every type of infection. How can they be in every type of infection?
Yeah.
Fluctuance is basically when you have that well-developed ball of fluid or purulence and you palpate it and you kind of have one hand on the area where the purulence is and you almost poke it or press it with the other hand, and you can kind of feel this fluid wave move a little bit. And it's not like a huge, wave in the Pacific Ocean. It's very, very subtle.
Yes.
But I would remember having like attendings and people, oh, look at the fluctuance. And I'm like trying to palpate. I can't tell if there's fluctuance there. I mean, I press on and the patient screams their guts out. That's all I know.
Yeah. But I mean, it helps you, like let's say they are, you have no idea how really exactly how long it's been going on, but you feel you're okay.
Yeah.
There's an abscess here for sure.
Yeah.
But this stages of infection also kind of helps me in my mind when I was thinking like post-surgical infections. Let's say you took a patient to surgery and then like the next day, the nurse or someone calls you, I think they're looking red or swollen. Do they have an infection? You wouldn't, just based on the timing, it helps you kind of just determine. You wouldn't expect cellulitis the next day or maybe even on day 2. You wouldn't expect an abscess that early. So like just keeping the days in mind and how long after certain things you would expect to see it, and
yep,
when you would expect to see an abscess is helpful for figuring out what's going on.
Stage 4 is resolution. So an abscess is going to either drain spontaneously, it will find its way out some way. If it's a superficial abscess, it often does. And then, or there's surgical drainage, which is where we're trying to catch it before it causes lots of trouble and potentially, severe consequences. And that begs the question of when to drain it, because many, especially in other specialties such as ENT and other people who deal with abscesses, oftentimes the thought is, well, you don't cut into it or drain it until it's an abscess or something to drain. But I think it's been pretty well established in oral maxillofacial surgery that it's good and okay to go in and drain a cellulitis, even though you're not going to get purulent drainage, opening up the space. And oftentimes, just getting in there and changing the nature of the infection and oxygen in there, antibiotics, stuff like that, can be very beneficial. Did you have any comments about that or things you've been taught with draining cellulitises?
No, just that's I've heard the same thing that, don't be totally disappointed if you go in to drain something, small and you weren't expecting a huge burst of fluid. If you don't find a huge burst of fluid, it doesn't mean you did the wrong thing, flush it out, clean it out. and it can still be beneficial. Of course, if you know that there's an abscess based on the imaging, you know, you need to get that. But yeah, I think that's the main thing. One thing I wanted to point out, you know, as we're finishing up here, is just that when we do post this, I've tried to go and look at all the stuff that we had intended to talk about and then make like a little summary slide on it that we're gonna share on our Instagram. And if you guys want to just take a look at that, it has a good, you know, just like three or four real quick images of review of all of this stuff, odontogenic infections, and even a little bit more just to have at your fingertips if you want to, you know, refer back to it ever.
Yeah. And in that same vein, also, if there were things we missed in this podcast about infections that you thought were really important, it'd be great if you could jump on there and add that on to the post that we put with a comment about this is also important or whatever the case may be. So feel free to comment on that stuff. Yeah, hopefully this can help some of those out there that are dealing with infections.
Yep. Awesome. We'll keep it up. And like we said, we were trying to pick just kind of core oral surgery stuff residents need to know and keep doing these episodes here and there to help out.
Sounds good. Thanks, Jake.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Everyday Oral Surgery. For more information on these podcasts, please visit everydayoralsurgery.com. I would love it if you would also connect with us on Instagram and Facebook through our Everyday Oral Surgery pages. Also, if you are an oral and maxillofacial surgeon and would like to be on this podcast, please, please email me at grantstuckey@gmail.com, or you can text or call me at 720-441-6059. If you have any topics that you'd like to hear discussed on this podcast or feedback on certain episodes that have already aired, also please call or email me. I've found many of our interviewees through people contacting me after listening, and for that I am supremely grateful. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you on the next episode.